It was supposed that these boulders were carried by chance on natural rafts of closely drifting logs and thus became embedded in the coal. Close rafts of drifting trunks are conceivable only after a great hurricane. However, marine fish would not enter deeply into inundating rivers to be entombed together with the boulders, and coral does not grow in muddy water. Apparently the coal was not formed in the ways described. Forests burned, a hurricane uprooted them, and a tidal wave or succession of tidal waves coming from the sea fell upon the charred and splintered trees and swept them into great heaps, tossed by billows, and covered them with marine sand, pebbles and shells, and weeds and fishes. Another tide deposited on top of the sand more carbonized logs, threw them in other heaps, and again covered them with marine sediment. The heat of ground metamorphosed the charred wood into coal, and if the wood or the ground where it was buried was drenched in a bituminous outpouring, bituminous coal was formed. Wet leaves sometimes survived the forest fires and, swept into the same heaps of logs and sand, left their design on the coal. Thus it is that seams of coal are covered with marine sediment. For that reason also a seam may bifurcate and have marine deposits between its branches. A support of this my view on the origin of coal I find in a recently published extensive work by Herbert Nielsen, Professor Emeritus of Botany at Lund University. Nielsen presents the results of an inquiry into the botanical and zoological composition of the brown coal, lignite, of Geiseltal in Germany, made by Johannes Weigelt of Halle and his group. Many plants found in Geiseltal lignite are tropical, of species that do not grow even in the subtropics. A long list of tropical families, genera, and species, discerned in Geiseltal coal, was made known. Besides the dominating tropical flora in Geiseltal, plants are represented there from almost every part of the globe. The associated insect fauna of Geiseltal coal is found in present Africa, in East Asia, and in America in various regions, preserved in almost original purity, Walther and Weigelt. The coal of Geiseltal is rated as belonging to the beginning of the tertiary time. As to the reptilian, avian, and mammalian fauna, the coal is a veritable graveyard. Apes, crocodiles, and marsupials, pouch animals, left their remains in this coal. An Indo's, Australian bird, an American condor, tropical giant snakes, East Asian salamanders, left their remains there too. Coon, some of the animals are of the steppe habitat, and others, like crocodiles, came from swamps. Not only do the origin and the habitats of plants and animals offer a very paradoxical picture, but so also does their state of preservation. Chlorophyll is preserved in the leaves found in the brown coal, Weigelt and Noack. The leaves must have been rather quickly excluded from contact with air and light, or rapidly entombed. These were neither leaves falling off the plants in the fall nor leaves exposed to the action of light and atmosphere after being torn off by a storm. Entire strata of leaves from all parts of the world, counted by the billions, though torn to shreds but with their fine fibers, nevatch, intact, in many cases still green, are found in the Geiseltal lignite. It is not different with the animals. If exposed after death for any length of time to natural conditions, the structure of animal tissues loses its fineness. The muscles and the epidermis, skin, of the animals of the brown coal of Geiseltal were found to have retained their fine structure. Also the colors of the insects are preserved in their original splendor. The very process of fossilization with silica invading the tissues must have occurred fast, blitzschnell, almost instantaneously, in Nielsen's opinion. While the membranes and the colors of the insects are preserved so well, it is difficult to find a complete insect. Mostly only torn parts are found, voided. Nielsen is convinced that the animals and plants found in Geiseltal coal were carried there by onrushing water from all parts of the world, but mainly from the coasts of the equatorial belt of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, from Madagascar, Indonesia, Australia, and the west coast of the Americas. One thing is, however, evident: coal originated in cataclysmic circumstances. Chapter 14, Extinction. Fossils. Millions of buffaloes have died natural deaths on the prairies of the West in the more than 400 years since the discovery of America, Their flesh has been eaten by scavengers or putrefied and disintegrated, their bones and teeth resisted for a while the decaying process, but finally weathered and crumbled to powder. No bones of these dead buffaloes became fossils in sedimentary rocks, and scarcely any are found in a state of preservation. The evolutionary theory of the formation of fossils makes certain conditions obligatory. Sedimentary rock is formed in a slow process on the bottom of the sea, and the bones of animals buried in the sediment become fossilized. Land animals wade in the shallow waters of the sea or lakes, die when wading, and their bodies are covered with sediment. The sediment must quickly cover the animals, and this is most possible when the ground subsides. Therefore, Darwin postulated such subsidence of the sea bottom as a condition for the formation of fossils. On the other hand, the subsidence or emergence of the ground in the theory of uniformity or evolution is a very slow process, longer by far than the time necessary for a cadaver to disintegrate in water. The giant reptiles are supposed to have lived as amphibians, on land and in the shallow sea, because of the numerous fossil remains in sedimentary rock. However, no signs of adaptation for aquatic life are found in their skeletons. Their bodies were so heavy, it is assumed, that they looked for an opportunity to wade or swim, though it would seem that if they had difficulty in carrying their bodies on land, they must have experienced still more difficulty in dragging themselves out of the muddy ground of the shallow water on the beaches. Birds too are supposed to have died while wading and been buried. When a fish dies, its body floats on the surface or sinks to the bottom and is devoured rather quickly, actually in a matter of hours, by other fish. However, the fossil fish found in sedimentary rock is very often preserved with all its bones intact. Entire shoals of fish over large areas, numbering billions of specimens, are found in a state of agony, but with no mark of a scavenger's attack. The explanation of the origin of fossils by the theory of uniformity and evolution contradicts the fundamental principle of these theories: nothing took place in the past that does not take place in the present. Today no fossils are formed. Petrified bones of reptiles, birds, and mammals are often found in large unbroken areas, and since it is quite difficult to describe such areas as wading places, another explanation of the origin of fossils is sometimes offered: the animals were drowned and buried in inundations of large rivers. This explanation seems for certain cases generally closer to the truth than the wading theory. However, the size of the continental areas covered by floods imply catastrophic events on a large scale, and such events, far beyond what is observed on seasonally overflowing rivers today, again contradict the principle of uniformity. Finally, the very process of sediment formation is not without its problem. Sediment building is supposed to go off permanently in the sea, the building material being the detritus carried by the rivers or broken by the billows from the rocks on the coast and, mainly, the ooze, or calcareous skeletons of myriads of minute living beings, which are abundant in the sea and find their graves on the bottom. The thickness of the sediment on the bottom of the ocean is supposed to give a timetable for the age of the ocean. But, contrary to expectation, in some places on the bottom of the ocean core samples have detected almost no sedimentary rock, indicating that the bottom of the ocean was formed in those places only recently, and in other places, even on land, the sedimentary rock is enormously thick, sometimes tens of thousands of feet. If one and the same process continually and equally deposits the calcareous ooze and detritus on the sea bottom, the inequalities in sedimentary bedrock are as little explained as the formation of fossils. Both these phenomena are explainable by cataclysmic events in the past. The floor of the ocean was lifted in some places and dropped in others, the sediment was violently shifted, the content of the ocean depths was spilled onto the land. Land animals were engulfed and buried by enormous tides carrying debris. In many places, avalanches of sand and volcanic dust entombed the aquatic life, fish skeletons remaining in poses of death, undevoured and undecayed. Footprints. In numerous places and in various formations are found footprints of animals of prehistoric times. Those of dinosaurs and other animals are clearly impressed in rock. The accepted explanation is that these animals walked on muddy ground, and their imprints were preserved as the ground became hard and stony. This explanation cannot stand up against critical examination. On muddy ground one may find impressions of the hoofs of cattle or horses, but the very next rain will smudge these impressions, and after a short while they will be there no more. If we do not find the hoof prints of cattle that passed along a path the season before, how is it that the toe imprints of animals of pre-diluvial times remain intact in the mud on which they walked? The imprints must have been made like impressions in soft sealing wax that hardens before they are blurred or obliterated. The ground must have been soft when the animal ran upon it, and then it quickly hardened before changes could take place. Sometimes we see imprints of animals that chanced to walk over freshly laid concrete. While the substance was soft, a dog or a bird or a large insect might have walked on it and left impressions recognizable when it hardened. Also, heated sand, turning into a viscous substance on its way to becoming hardened glass, could receive and preserve imprints. The vestiges could also remain in muddy, unheated ground that was soon covered by lava which filled in the imprints and later disintegrated on being weathered away. In historical times, in the volcanic destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum, lava and volcanic ashes filled the wheel tracks in the streets of these cities and thus preserved them to our day. In the eruption of Kilauea in Hawaii in 1790, when many people lost their lives, and with them a brigade of the Hawaiian army, the footprints of trapped humans and animals were retained in the hardened volcanic ash. Wherever footprints in the ground dating from historical or prehistoric times are found, we may assume that most probably a catastrophe took place when these vestiges were left or very shortly thereafter. If a catastrophe was in progress or was threatening, the animals must have been in terror and flight. The footprints actually show that the animals in most cases were fleeing, not wading or loitering about. Sometimes the configuration of the impressions indicates that an animal was indecisive, probably trapped by some peril closing in from all sides. The animals that were in flight for their lives may have succumbed a few moments later, crushed or burned in the disaster. The ground was swept by driven sand and ashes or covered by lava or asphalt, or cement, or fluid silicon, then possibly covered by floods, and the imprints in the heated soil that was baked to stone have survived to the present day. So it is that we do not find tracks of animals that peacefully walked 100 or 300 years ago, but we do find traces and vestiges of animals that walked and ran many thousands of years ago. The caverns. It has been observed that when in a great panic carnivorous animals and the animals that usually are their prey flee together without falling upon each other or being afraid of each other. So when forests burn, horses and wolves, gazelles and hyenas flee along the same paths, all gripped by the same terror, paying no attention to one another. When prairies burn or jungles are enveloped in flame, wild beasts and tame creatures in mixed herds stampede to save their lives. In earthquake or in flood, animals lose their mutual animosity in a common fear. It has also been observed that in earthquakes and other calamities, wild animals will come to the abodes of men. In their great migrations, animals behave differently than when they travel singly or in small herds, so lemming, which scurry away from a man at the sound of his footsteps, will overrun house, town, and river when migrating in large bands, perishing in great numbers but going forward in a huge wave. In great natural catastrophes, animals seek cover from terrifying phenomena, floods, falling meteorites, burning forests, and frightening portents in the sky. Caverns are the places of refuge most sought. An instinct in animals impels them to escape into a den, a hole in the ground, and large animals run for caverns. They may remember such places in the hour of catastrophe. And, one may follow another of course, many animals never reach the shelter of a cave, but some of them do. And when, in the detritus on the floor of a cave, bones are found of animals that usually would not associate, and the bones are mixed together, and those of the prey animals are not crushed by the teeth of the carnivores, then it is almost certain that these animals tried to save themselves, unafraid of one another, in this cave and the face of approaching catastrophe. It is possible that some of the animals in the shelter survived the catastrophe, and then their wild instincts must have returned, but in many cases all of them succumbed, overwhelmed by gases, smoke, eddying currents on the surface of the earth, and tides that burned them under sedimentation. In numerous places of the world the bone content of caves indicates that they served as hideouts in tunes of supreme danger. Lions and tigers, wolves and hyenas, gazelles and hares shared the refuge and there found their common grave. But not all places where such assemblages of bones are discovered were sought for refuge. In many cases the animals were swept from large areas by a tidal wave and thrown against rocks, and the water rushing through the fissures left behind the animals with all their bones broken within their torn bodies. From as far as China, to England and France and the islands of the Mediterranean, examples of fissures with bones, splintered and mingled together, have been presented in this book. Not only fissures in the rocks but caverns in the hills may have been filled with bones, though the caverns might not originally have been sought for shelter. An erupting sea or great lake, lifted from its bed and carrying its own detritus and land debris, swept heterogeneous herds of animals and carried them to the farthest reaches and threw over them hills of gravel, rock, and earth. Cumberland Cave, described on an earlier page, is one of many examples. If the bones are found rolled, they were most probably carried from afar, and were from animals that had died long before. If the bones are more or less intact, the chances are that the place was a shelter that failed, and if the bones are splintered, it is highly probable that the animals were smashed by a great force against rocks or resisting ground. Extinction. Many forms of life, many species and genera of animals that lived on this planet in a recent geological period, in the age of man, have utterly disappeared without leaving a single survivor. Mammals walked in fields and forests, propagated and multiplied, and then without a sign of degeneration vanished. A considerable group have become extinct virtually within the last few thousand years. The large mammals that died out, in America, include all the camels, all the horses, all the ground sloths, two genera of musk, oxen, peccaries, certain antelopes, a giant bison with a horn spread of 6 feet, a giant beaver-like animal, a stag, moose, and several kinds of cats, some of which were of lion size. Also the imperial elephant and the Colombian mammoth, animals larger than the African elephant and common all over North America, disappeared. The mastodon that inhabited the forests and ranged from Alaska to the Atlantic coast and Mexico, and the woolly mammoth that roamed in a broad area adjacent to the ice sheets, likewise persisted until a few thousand years. The dire wolf, the saber-toothed tiger, the short-faced bear, the small horse disappeared, and are no longer found either in the old or in the new world. Many birds, too, became extinct. These species are believed to have been destroyed to the last specimen in the closing ice age. Animals, strong and vigorous, suddenly died out without leaving a survivor. The end came, not in the course of the struggle for existence, with the survival of the fittest. Fit and unfit, and mostly fit, old and young, with sharp teeth, with strong muscles, with fleet legs, with plenty of food around, all perished. These facts, as I have already quoted, drive a biologist to despair as he surveys the extinction of so many species and genera in the closing Pleistocene. In the woolly mammoth, the genus of elephants achieved its evolutionary perfection, as was already shown by Falconer and known to Darwin. The teeth of the mammoth were superior to those of modern elephants, and in many other respects their adaptation was perfect. The theory of evolution had in the mammoth one of the best examples of a species evolving in the struggle for survival by adaptation. Stone Age man made drawings of it, possibly he even domesticated some of them. In the Neolithic, Stone Age, town of Predmost in Moravia, bones of 800 to 1000 mammoths were found, their shoulder blades were used in building tombs. On the vast plains of northern Siberia they roamed in herds. They succumbed there as if in one cold night that fell over the land and knew no recess thereafter. They did not die from starvation, their food was found in their stomachs and also between their teeth. The best preserved body of a mammoth, with even its eyeballs intact, was found in Berezovka, Siberia, 800 miles west of Bering Strait. a fractured hip and forelimb, a great mass of clotted blood in the chest, and unswallowed grass between the clenched teeth, all point to the violence and suddenness of its passing. Did it fall into a pit, or was it tossed by hurricanes and floods? It appears that it was some sudden and unexpected cataclysm, for the mammoths, together with rhinoceroses, bison, and others whose bones and teeth make the main substance of the New Siberian Islands, fill the bottom of the Arctic Ocean above Siberia, and lie in the frozen earth of the Siberian tundras. At about the same time the mammoth also perished in Europe and in America. The mastodon, too, was exterminated at the dawn of the present era. There was no scarcity of their food, it consisted of herbs, leaves, and bark, as is known from the undigested food found within their skeletons. They lived in all parts of the Americas. Over 200 skeletons were unearthed in New York State. It is not known what brought this widespread group to an end. Fossil bones of horses indicate that this was a very common animal in the New World in the Ice Age. But when the soldiers of Cortes, arriving at the shores of America, rode their horses which they had brought from the Old World, the natives thought that gods had come to their country. They had never seen a horse. Of the horses the Spaniards brought to America, some went astray, became wild, and filled the prairies, traveling in herds. The land and its vegetation and its climate proved to be exceedingly well suited for the propagation of this animal. In many parts of the Americas, fossil hunters found fossilized bones of horses in great numbers, often embedded in rock or in lava, which do not differ in shape from the bones of the present-day horse. Why did the horse become extinct with the end of the Ice Age if the climate became so favorable? In earlier ages there were in America different-looking horses, with three-toed feet, also very small horses the size of cats. However, the one that looked exactly like a modern horse inhabited America and there became extinct only several thousand years before Cortes brought the European horse to the shores of the New World. Was not the American horse wiped out by man? In our time the American bison, buffalo, was almost destroyed by man, but he used horses to pursue them and firearms to kill them. C. O. Sayer has advanced the theory, 1944. That the terminal Ice Age fauna was destroyed by man, by hunters making fire, drives in pursuit of game. However, Stone Age hunters burning down forests would not have been able to destroy completely many species of animal, leaving not one of the kind from one coast to another and from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. F. Rainey, now of the University of Pennsylvania, has observed that in certain regions of Alaska the bones of these extinct animals he so thickly scattered that there can be no question of human handiwork involved. Though man was on the scene of the final perishing, his was not, then, the appetite nor the capacity for such giant slaughter. And because of the wholesale and rapid extermination of fauna, it seems impossible to attribute the phenomenon to the unaided efforts of man. Even with the known destructiveness of man, however, it is difficult to visualize how these early hunters, armed with puny flint-tipped spears, could have destroyed enough animals to cause complete extinction. But whatever the actual cause or causes may have been, there is no doubt that the end of the ice masses also saw the end of the exotic animals of the same period. The ice cliffs in the background have shriveled and gone. The trumpeting herds of mammoths and the pounding hooves of the other animals are no more. Isley of the University of Kansas wrote, "We are not dealing with a single, isolated relict species but with a considerable variety of Pleistocene, Ice Age, forms, all of which must be accorded, in the light of cultural evidence, an approximately similar time of extinction. Then could it have been a disease that caused the extinction? Or the change in climate because of the termination of the Ice Age?" Professor Isley finds that epidemic disease or lunatic events attendant on the glacial retreat are sufficient to explain an enormous reduction in the number of a particular species, but are yet inadequate to illuminate the reason for the inability of the species to rebound, in a few years, from its decimated condition. W. Besides, no known disease would attack so many species and genera. And as for the climatic factor, if glacial conditions are the cause, then, according to G. E. Pilgrim, At approximately the same time we witness a similar extinction of the mammal faunas of Africa and Asia, though in their case this may not have been caused by glacial conditions. But even a sudden climatic catastrophe all over the world could hardly have been adequate by itself to account for an extermination so wide and, for many species, so complete. Climatic change alone is not enough to explain the extinction of the marvelous Pleistocene fauna. There have been other suggestions, such as clouds of volcanic gases which destroyed whole herds of mammals. Of what dimensions must these clouds have been? They must have covered almost the entire terrestrial globe. But all the volcanoes of the Earth, erupting together, would not be sufficient to destroy so many species and genera. Many agents of destruction must have united their forces with the sudden revolution of the climate to wipe out a major part of the animal population of the Earth, with many genera and species leaving no survivors. The extermination of great numbers of animals of every species, and of many species in their entirety, was the effect of recurrent global catastrophes. Of some species, every animal was exterminated in one part of the world, but a number of animals succeeded in surviving in another part of the world, so the horses and camels of the Americas were destroyed without a survivor. Yet in Eurasia, though decimated, they were not exterminated. But many species were completely extinguished, in the Old World as well as in the New, mammoths and mastodons and others. They expired not because of lack of food or inadequate organic evolution, inferior build or lack of adaptation. Plentiful food and superb bodies and fine adaptation and solid procreation, but no survival of the fit. They died as if a wind had snuffed life out of all of them, leaving their cadavers, with no sign of degeneration, in asphalt pits, in bogs, in sediment, in caverns. Some of the decimated species probably endured for a while, possibly for several centuries, being represented by a few specimens of their kind, but in changed surroundings, amid climatic vicissitudes, with pastures withered, with plants that had served as food or animals that had served as prey gone. These few followed the rest in a losing battle for existence, surrendering at last in the struggle for survival of a species. Burning forests, trespassing seas, erupting volcanoes, submerging lands took the major toll. Impoverished fields and burned down forests did not offer favorable conditions for frightened and solitary survivors, and claimed their own share in the work of extinction. Chapter 15, Cataclysmic Evolution, Catastrophism and Devolution. The theory of evolution dates back to the age of classic Greece, one of its proponents having been Anaximander, and from time to time philosophers have offered the evolutionary explanation of the origin of the multiple forms of life on Earth, as opposed to the theory of special creation or the permanency of living forms from the day of creation. Lamarck thought that acquired characteristics were transmissible by heredity and thus might lead to the appearance of new forms of life. In 1840, the year that Agassiz's Ice Age theory was published, an anonymously printed work, Vestiges of Creation, written by Robert Chambers, caused a stir that did not subside for years. It was bitterly attacked by every British scientist for teaching that human beings are the children of apes and the breeders of monsters. In the words of one critic, the president of the Geological Society, Adam Sedgwick, Darwin later acknowledged that the brunt of the attack against his own theory was absorbed by Vestiges. What was new in Darwin's teaching was not the principle of evolution in general, but the explanation of its mechanism by natural selection. This was an adaptation to biology of the Malthusian theory about population growing more quickly than the means of existence. Darwin acknowledged his debt to Malthus, whose book he read in 1838. Herbert Spencer and Alfred R. Wallace independently came to the same views as Darwin, and the expression survival of the fittest was Spencer's. Darwin wrote his theory with the point of his pen directed against the theory of catastrophism. He hardly expected that no opposition would come from the side he attacked, otherwise he would not have expended so many arguments in combating catastrophism and in subscribing so completely to Lyell's theory of uniformity in lifeless nature. As it turned out, most of the attacks against Darwin came from the church, which could not agree that man had risen from inferior beings. The church held to the dogmas of creation in 6 days less than 6,000 years ago, and of the primal sin of Adam, to redeem humankind from which the Son of Man came into this world, also to the view that beasts have no souls and therefore a barrier stands between man and animal.